Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Something Something podcast. My name is Eric Kasloff, and ladies and gentlemen, with me as always is Larry Sands. How's it going, Larry?
Man, oh man, it's getting a little bit better, Eric, now that I heard that. That's the first time you've said that all year.
I'm going to get right into it. I almost died, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, no
that's why
joke.
we were gonna do a wrap-up show for the year, but I got a pretty bad infection in my leg, and I've talked about my health issues. Here's where I'll get the highlights of the story. I went to a hospital near me in Hackensack, New Jersey. They were afraid to touch my leg because of all my other health issues. So a doctor who works for them, while he was looking at one of my wounds. Now, again, this man's paychecks say Hackensack University. And he told me and my mom, you need to go to NYU. So I was in that hospital for 11 days, in NYU for 11 days, came home for 2 days, went back to NYU for like another 5 or 8 days, came home for 2 days, went back to NYU for a long time. So yeah, man, apparently because of the infection, I went septic and I could have died. And it's
Man,
pretty intense.
It is intense, but
we're
something
gonna
just
do a whole podcast breaking down everything that happened during the time. Well, stuff that I could remember, because while I was there, I discovered something called Dilaudid that helps with pain. And holy cow. Wow.
I was going to say,
it's like getting a hug from Jesus is the best way I could describe that medicine. But Larry, while I was there, you know, I'm a reader. Unlike you, I like reading because I can. And, you know, I love talking with writers. And man, I also am passionate about movies. And when I saw who our guest is, I was like, oh my God, is this the guy who they base Blow on? But no, Larry, tell us about our guest.
Oh my goodness gracious, Eric. Actually, that is probably the closest movie probably out there, right? Or maybe Scarface? I don't know. Ladies and gentlemen, our first show back is a doozy. How can I say this? Tom, welcome to the show. And I'm trying to pick out my correct words to pitch this, but I don't think I'm able to. It is an incredible two story though, right? And the book is called Next Run. And it chronicles your life. How could I put this? Should I just put it out there?
Sure.
Yeah.
As a drug runner?
I prefer the term smuggler.
Perfect. Excellent. I love it. Yes. So did Han Solo.
Exactly.
No, this is absolutely amazing. A smuggler. And this was in the 60s, correct?
And early 70s.
60s and early 70s. Wow. Tell us about your book and everything that has gone on with it.
Sure, I will. I've got to tell you, though, as a physician, I'm kind of drawn to Eric's story. Evidently, he had a cellulitis. I'm wondering if he has diabetes and all this, but that's not the subject of this talk. So
not
let
at
me
all.
get
I don't
to
have any of that.
Smuggling. Back in the 60s, 1965 to be specific, I was a student at UC Berkeley, and I got pretty caught up in the 60s. I fell in love with pot and brought some pot back from Mexico on a lark with two friends. As a result of that, I had established a contact. I never imagined becoming a smuggler. I thought that would just be a story to tell my grandchildren, as they say. But then a number of coincidences happened, and I got involved with smuggling pot into the country in straight-looking cars driven by straight-looking secretaries. I then graduated to using planes. I partnered with a pilot, and We were bringing in a half ton at a time. Lasted for 11 runs, quite a few runs. And it eventually fell through thanks to Nixon's Operation Intercept. I hate to give Nixon credit for anything, but then I resorted to wading 80-pound sacks through the Rio Grande, which is actually kind of fun. I've always been kind of a nature buff, and being out on the Rio Grande in the middle of the night was kind of a thrill. That didn't last too long on account of the people I was working with. And I ended up running out of ideas, and I actually became a totally legitimate and legal importer of embroidered clothing from Mexico with my girlfriend. And we roamed around Mexico in a pickup truck with the surfboards on top, living like gypsies for 2 years. But my reputation in the smuggling underworld persisted, and I was invited to become a partner and manage the Colombian end of an operation using a Beechcraft D18, which is a twin-engine cargo plane, to carry it a ton at a time out of Colombia with a drop of bales to the water off the coast of Florida to be picked up by waiting speedboats. And at the same time, my Mexican contacts were sending me tons at a time. They started with 2 tons and then 6 tons. And they were crossing the California-Mexico border in a semi past a border guard that they had bribed. That went on for several months, during which I made a lot of money. And I did something very unusual, which shocked the smuggling world.
Okay.
Okay, I'm
That's,
hooked. I want to know more.
yeah, that's absolutely amazing. When you were doing all this, and maybe this is a two-part question, is when you were doing all this, did you realize at the time, and this may be a weird question, did you realize at the time what you were doing? And then, and I guess maybe what I mean is, you know, obviously when we do things in our past and we grow up and we look back on them now, is it a fond memory? Is it a memory that for better or worse is an exciting memory?
Absolutely. I had a ball, I only did it, and you've brought up an interesting subject that I hadn't really thought about speaking of, but it's in the book. I did it because I was crazy. You'd have to be crazy, really.
Right.
I was very bright, middle class, and white, so I had all the advantages, and living in California, I mean, what more can you want for to get started in life? And for me to risk all of that was really insane. But I had actually identified mental illness in myself at age 6, and it was the 50s. People didn't talk much about mental illness. In fact, the word depression, depressed, those are words you hear practically every day nowadays. Those words weren't used much in the 50s. Psychoanalysis was really popular in the 50s, but it was more of a fad thing to analyze yourself. And mental illness was not that well understood or spoken about in that time. And the fascinating thing is that I pretty much got halfway to overcoming my mental illness through smuggling, a very odd way to do it. But I ended up coming very close with a lot of male role models. And that helped a lot because that was something I needed. Towards the end of the book, I hint at how I finished the process of completely ridding myself of the mental illness that I ended up with as a child. So I got, because I got away with it, they are fond memories. If I hadn't gotten away with it, I don't think I'd be very fond of them.
Right. You wouldn't have wrote a book and you wouldn't be on the podcast
Exactly.
right now.
And I gotta tell you know, as a physician, I worked in a hospital for quite a few years and treated prisoners. We had a jail ward, And when I saw them shackled and wearing orange, I couldn't help but thinking, there but for fortune go I.
Oh man,
And it was
wow.
a weird experience.
Yeah, I bet. I
So I
bet.
want to know about doing these runs and, working with the cartels pretty much. Was there any fear involved or was there an adrenaline? I think that's what you were hinting at, the adrenaline of doing something like this.
Okay, that's a great question. First of all, it was totally different from anything you've ever seen in film or in another book. It was
Really?
all upbeat. The cartels hadn't yet been established. The honor and integrity of the people I dealt with was unbelievable. It
Wow.
goes beyond, in some ways, what I see in the so-called straight legal world. Just to give you an example, when the Mexican contacts were sending me tons at a time, I didn't want to go near this stuff. So what I did is I had three trusted friends, and I just told them, go in and take out a certain allotment, and they did. And I didn't lose, a kilogram of that stuff. They were very honest. They paid me for everything they took out. And there's a kind of funny irony in that too, because a lot of this was kind of like funny money and almost had an unreal quality to it. So during one of these 6-ton runs, hey Tom, I want to borrow your Martin guitar. I've got a gig tonight. And I was just horrified that he would ask to borrow my guitar. I wouldn't loan that guitar to anyone. And
Right.
then he left disappointed. And I thought to myself, well, I'm trusting him with God knows how many hundreds of thousand dollars of grass. And I won't loan him a guitar that isn't even worth $1,000. But the difference was the guitar was real. And the money in the grass, it was kind of like funny money and funny grass. Yeah, there was some reality to it.
So this is before cocaine and, Escobar became like the kingpin on all that stuff. So you were just mainly pot was like the main thing.
Well, yes, but heroin became involved. There was constant pressure for me to move heroin, which I turned down. But my roommate jumped my contact, and to jump a contact means to learn about it through someone, but establish contact without that person's permission. And he began a smuggling operation. And in fact, do you want me to just read a passage about this guy?
Oh, yes, God
Please.
bless. Yes.
Okay, so here he is talking about the first time that he's brought the heroin across. He told me about their first run when they ran 2 ounces. He said he simply taped them underneath his balls and walked across. Quote, you know the feeling. You're hanging around Tijuana. You get your shoes shined by some little kid. You knock off a couple quick shots at a bar. And then there's no more stalling around, and you've got to do it. I was in the pedestrian line, and this old bastard pulled me over to the side and frisked me. I felt his hands work up my legs and saw my whole life pass before my eyes. But when his hands bumped the ounces, he didn't even react. I'm telling you, these ounces were packed so tight with tape, they were like rocks. Jake made a fist and laughed. He must have thought I had cast iron balls or something. Ha ha, not to mention the size. I'll tell you though, Tom, having money has really changed my life. When I think back to the way I was living just 6 months ago, I realize I didn't like myself very much. Like that time I got busted for having a kit in my car. I was dealing dime bags on the street and cutting guys up in card games just to stay alive. Now I don't have to mess with any of that. That's what money can do for you. It can allow you to become a better person. Jake rocked back in his chair and laughed. He was a keenly intelligent guy who saw the irony in everything he was saying and loved it. He had his hands clasped behind his head and grinned. Yep, he concluded, it's nice to be able to afford morals.
Wow. It's hard to imagine because, when you grow up and watch the movies, right? But then I guess it was the fun-loving 60s, right? And 70s in a way. And the way that your book or the passage in your book you just read, it's so matter-of-factly. Because when you look at things today, I mean, they'll kill you. Did you ever, and I know you had said that, it was different. It wasn't that that killer vibe. But did you ever once, when you were talking to these guys, like feel like they were going to kill you in any way if you messed up?
Not at all.
Wow.
And that's despite the fact that one of my contacts did commit an assassination, which I'll tell you about in a second.
Wait,
But
whoa.
he committed
What?
an assassination. Yeah.
Go on.
Well, I'm going to tell you about that. But
Okay.
I want to emphasize these guys became my best friends. We were
Wow.
extremely close. We cried together, we shared our most intimate thoughts together. I love these guys, and I'm sorry they're both dead at this point. But, and they were very honorable, very nice guys. And the one in particular, his name was Abelardo, and he was very thoughtful and kind. However, the head of the state police of the state of Sinaloa was a prick and had killed people for no reason, just for the pleasure it gave him. And he, at one evening, accosted Abelardo's brother in his home, and his brother stepped in front of his wife, his own wife, to protect her. The chief shot him with a 357 Magnum with one bullet. It passed through both the guy and his wife and killed them both. So
Whoa.
Abelardo drove to Tucson, bought a used Mustang, drove back to Culiacan, hired a driver and a pistolero, and the pistolero was and two machine guns, and the pistolero was under strict orders not to shoot unless Abelardo first missed. And when the chief stepped out of his office, Abelardo cut him down with a spray of machine gun fire, and a chase ensued. And Abelardo got away in this Mustang they had bought, and they set it on fire. But they should have realized that's not going to erase the vehicle identification number. So they
Oh
were able to
boy.
trace the car to the lot in Tucson and eventually to Abelardo. But Abelardo had friends in the police department, so he got tipped off, and he became a fugitive for a couple of years. He went into very deep hiding. Just virtually no one knew where he was. But after a year or so, he got word to me that he wanted to meet me and my girlfriend. This is when we were importing embroidered clothing, and I was very honored. I met him in downtown Guadalajara, and he said that he had learned a lot in the Sierra where he was hiding. He had learned how to grow sin semilla, which was new in the early 70s. It had just been kind of developed. And he had a bunch of fields that were going to, mature, and he wanted to show me the fields, and I was dying to see a field because I had never seen one before. But he said it was a 2-day burro ride into the deep into the Sierra, and he said that my girlfriend couldn't come, and he assured me it's not because I don't trust her, because she's your woman, I trust her completely, but a blonde in this area would attract way too much attention. And I couldn't leave my girlfriend stuck in Guadalajara for a bunch of days. So I had to pass up my one chance to see a field.
Hey, here's a question, and I know that you're a physician now. Did you know Spanish before doing all this, or did you teach yourself Spanish?
I started teaching myself when I was 7, and well, I was partially raised on a farm, my grandparents' farm, and the farm next to them was owned by Mexicans, and they had 12 kids, and I loved playing
Oh.
with their kids, but I got frustrated when their kids would talk amongst themselves in their secret language. So
Right.
I started trying to learn at age 7. I didn't get very far though, but then in junior high and high school, I learned a fair amount.
Yeah.
And then through smuggling, I got fluent.
Oh, a
Wow.
lot. That's absolutely wild and insane. You know, it just occurred to me, a lot of people go and they do like extreme sports, right? You became a smuggler. Wow. And you did mention Sinaloa. So it was that almost like the start of the Sinaloa cartel?
Well, Sinaloa was, kind of the drug growing center. There's also Durango, and I think I'm blanking on the other state nearby, but yeah, that was kind of where the grass was grown, and Culiacan was the place where the dealers lived, and kind of for good reason. I mean, it wasn't a tourist town, and probably in those days they wanted to lie low and not interfere in any way with the tourist trade.
Right.
Maybe, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Although there was a fair amount of dealing going on in Mazatlan, which was a tourist town. You want to hear another story? I've
I
got a
yeah.
billion of them.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, here's another one about just one of the amazing coincidences that occurred to me, and also has a touch of irony in it. And this was during the plane runs. And my contacts felt this was such an ongoing operation that they needed a place to store the grass prior to our picking it up. So they created an underground cavern out of concrete, which
What?
was located at a remote ranchito south of Culiacan. And in the course of excavation, they unearthed a bunch of clay artifacts, pre-Columbian. And so I went to the cavern and I crawled through this narrow tunnel and got into the cavern. I looked at the grass, it was good. And as I was leaving the ranchito, the campesino who owned the ranchito came up and just gave me this box of artifacts. And I thanked him profusely and told them I would treasure them forever, which I have.
Oh,
And
wow.
there's a bunch more.
Wow.
Your listeners can't see them, but so anyway, the pickup went smoothly, and instead of flying home like I usually did, I got this urge to take the bus. I wanted to see the Mexican countryside roll by, and I wanted to reminisce along that highway because my previous partner and I had driven up and down that highway many times in the car running days. So there's hardly any Americans in Culiacan, but when I get in the bus, there's this older American at the back, and I quickly look away as I don't want, have company or anything. So I take a seat in the front. The bus gets rolling. The old guy comes up and wants to sit next to me. I can't say no. And he proceeds to bore the heck out of me with the details of his inconsequential straight life. But after a few minutes, it comes out he is a retired U.S. Customs officer. I'm thinking, I have just struck
My God.
gold. I'm going to milk this guy for everything I can get out of him. So I started
Wow.
encouraging him to talk about his work. And unfortunately, it comes out that in over 40 years of service, he never graduated above rooting through people's luggage and didn't know the first thing about planes or radar. So I couldn't get
Oh.
any useful information out of him. So it's a 22-hour trip to the border. He's boring me the whole time. He even follows me to restaurants during the rest
Oh,
breaks.
man.
We get to Nogales, and I'm really worried now because I know it's illegal to bring these artifacts back. So I open my bag, I get out a comb, I'm trying to make myself look as respectable as possible. Well, the retired inspector's instincts for peering into people's luggage didn't fail him, and he spots the artifacts and he says, "What are those?" And I said, "Oh, just some artifacts," and I close my bag. Well, he starts staring ahead. And in a really serious voice, he says, "I'm afraid it's my duty as a retired U.S. Customs official to tell you
Oh,
that it's illegal to bring those artifacts back. They
man.
belong to the government of Mexico." So at that point, I'm thinking, okay, he's bored me for 22 hours. Now he's going to prevent me from bringing back these artifacts. I'm going to strangle him. And he turns to me with this coy look and he says, "Tell you what, though, if they ask you what you're bringing back, don't call them artifacts, call them curios. And stick close to me. They're liable to be buddies of mine." So I
Oh,
did
wow.
exactly that. The custom people recognize him, don't ask a question, wave us on through, which just goes to show everyone's a smuggler at heart.
It's amazing.
I love
Yeah,
that.
it just kind of occurred to me that, yeah, and this is probably a totally crazy question, but did you like the little artifacts that you have, did you pick up things along the way that and you still have them, and then when you look at them, it absolutely reminds you of that time in your life? That's a weird question.
I don't know that it's weird. The sad answer is no. I have
Oh.
lost, aside from these artifacts, I don't even have a photograph of myself from those days. Yeah,
Really?
it's sad. Well,
Oh.
you know how it is when you're that age. You think your life
Yeah.
is going to go on forever. You don't realize that things always come to an end, right?
Right,
And
right.
so, and I was so in the middle of it that it didn't occur to me to stop and take photographs, you know?
Oh, wow.
And
Yeah.
so, yeah, I wish I did have some memorabilia from that era.
Yeah.
To get back to your other question, no, I never ever felt fear with my contacts. And in fact, there were a couple times where there was danger, and their first instinct was to get me out of the danger first,
Wow.
and leave the danger to them. Yeah.
Wow.
So there were two Breaking Bad type folks in my story. Without going into the
Yeah,
details,
yeah.
they ripped me off for $7,000, framed me, and had me thrown into the Mazatlan jail, and where I was told I
Oh.
would get 3 to 7 years.
What?
And but I'll just leave that as a hook.
Oh no, now he really has to get the book. This is amazing.
And that's actually my favorite section, the Mazatlan jail. It's a very interesting section. But
Wow.
yeah, these two guys, they were famous. They were the biggest dealers of those days. They were Manuel and Modestillo. And they were straight out of Breaking Bad. You
Wow.
couldn't get them to crack a smile. They were heavy, and sinister and all that crap. In fact, Modestillo wasn't even wearing a shirt when I met him. That was with good reason. He had all these knife scars all over his chest
Ooh.
that he kind of wanted to show off, and he had a gold crucifix dangling in his very hairy chest, so and a 45 tucked at his waist. So it
Wow.
was all part of the scene. But aside from that brief experience, my experience was the exact opposite of what you see in the films. And for that reason, I like to think of my book as Unbreaking Bad.
I like that.
That's very cool. That's very, very cool. How in the world, Tom, did you decide? Okay, how did you decide to write your book? And do you remember the moment you said, I should write it?
Oh, I mean, even while it was happening, I talked about writing it because it was so
Oh.
amazing. And it really followed a novelistic pattern. These coincidences and stuff, you see them in fiction.
Right.
Artists, writers have the license to create
Yes.
coincidences
Yeah.
in fiction. You don't expect it in a true
Right.
account. And yet, all these coincidences did happen. And there were times when I thought, gosh, is some higher power using me to try their hand at writing a novel or something?
Right.
So I knew it had to be written, it had to be told. And then when I got out of it, I sat down and wrote an entire account of it. And my writing sucked at the time, but I got all the facts down, and that proved incredibly valuable. Because if I hadn't done that, I think after a few years, I would have started to forget facts.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. How long did it take you to formally write your book?
Oh, 50 odd years. I mean, well,
Okay.
here's the thing. I got into medical school, which is very demanding, a residency. Being a rural doc, raising a family. I tried to write, here and there, my writing always sucked. I'd write, and of course, when I was writing it, I'd relive the days and I'd think, oh, wow, this is it, this is it. And a week later or 2 months later, I'd get a chance to look what I had written and it sucked. So for probably 4 decades or something, it was a very existential question for me. Was I ever going to be able to tell this story, or was I going to have to just give up and hire a ghostwriter to write it? And one time about 5 years ago, I had a week or so free and I wrote a bunch of stuff. I got busy. 6 months later, I went back and looked and I thought, whoa, this is it. It's coming alive. I finally did
Wow.
it.
Okay.
And from that
Okay.
point on, my writing just improved by huge jumps.
Wow.
And it's interesting, I've thought to myself, it took me so long to get to this point. And I like teaching. I mean, I taught medicine. And I thought, well, how would I teach someone else so that they could, get to where I just got to a lot faster? And it's really a hard question to answer. It's sort of like the way a child learns a language. I mean, the child has no idea how they're doing what they're doing, but they get it. They get the language. But I guess there's two things that I'd like to put out there for aspiring writers. And the first one is, I think it really helps to understand people and what makes them thick, because in the end, you have to please them and you have to give them stuff that's interesting to them. You have to let go of what you personally find interesting and understand what do people in general find interesting. And the second thing, which you probably won't find in many how to write books, or maybe you will, I don't know, but I think sentence structure is very important, the mechanics. I think it's very much like telling a joke. When you tell a joke, the words have to come in a very certain order, or the thing's going to fall flat. And do you guys remember EST by any chance, Erhard Sensitivity Training?
No,
For your
no.
listeners, EST was this movement in the 60s, 70s, where you could take all your problems, imagine them in the box, and then blow the box up in your mind, and your problems would be gone. That kind of thing. So there was this one line article in a newspaper that I thought was an example of how to phrase a sentence, and it went like this. An EST graduate was hospitalized yesterday with lacerations to his forearm after punching his fist through a window, which he had insisted was unreal. And so there's about five facts there, but if you scramble those facts in any other order, it's just not going to be as impactful. So I think that's an important thing for writers to understand.
Very important. But and actually Eric is a writer and director. And Tom, you're absolutely amazing. You have I can only imagine what it was like to be around you during this time, because you seem like a really a happy-go-lucky guy and
So
really
soft-spoken.
Great outlook, great attitude. And to hear you talk about it so fondly, I mean, I don't want to say it sounded romantic, but my God, when you don't have much to, and I say this because knowing what you said, and knowing today how violent the gangs are and the drug war is and everything, it does seem like, you know, it's not, it's weird. It's, and you just said it. Writers have to make this stuff up, but you didn't have to at all. At all. You just let it flow out of you.
The funny thing is, I feel a little bit bad about that. I feel like I couldn't write a novel because I'm just not creative. All I did was, explain what happened in an eloquent way. But I think to myself, well, I learned how to write. Now I ought to write another novel, but I just don't think I have the imagination to come up with the details.
I
I
don't know.
think you could.
I think because, you know, obviously this is your life, and it's not based on your life. It sounds like it is your life.
Yeah, it's
It's
true verbatim.
yeah,
It's not
yeah,
based on. It's true.
yeah, yeah. And almost, you know, how has the reaction been from? Do you still talk to your friends from back then? How do they? How do they react to something like this, or do they even know?
There's almost none of them left, sadly.
Oh, wow.
The one that is left is my girlfriend. We broke up, but we remained very close friends. And she loved the book. She's in it. She actually has a pretty big part in it.
Wow. That's, man, you know. I love being able to talk to people who have projects, creative people, and have followed through no matter what to finish their artwork, their projects. And is there anything that you feel that, and I may know the answer to this, but do you feel that you had to go through everything you went through to be the person you are today?
Yeah, I do. I sometimes feel bad because I was born with so many advantages. By testing, I was the brightest kid to go through my grammar school in a bunch of years. And so everyone thought I would grow up to be a great scientist. And I mean, on paper, I could have. But my psychiatric makeup made that impossible. I didn't understand people, and I had these mental difficulties that I had to get over, and I discovered a way to get over them by accident, really. I mean, I certainly didn't go into smuggling with the idea that, oh, I'm going to get rid of my mental problems doing this, but that's how it turned out. And I don't know how many years of psychoanalysis I would have needed if I had tried to become a scientist and behave like a totally normal, straight person in those youthful days. It would have been almost impossible, I think.
Yeah. And it never really ceases to amaze me how humble I think Eric, our guests are.
Seriously.
And I, you know, and it is a thing. I think, Tom, we go through things and when we look back on them, and I think this kind of goes for whenever we get to talk to our guests who have, you know, like their book and music and films they've completed, is they you can, and as an artist myself, I know the struggle of what it's like going through that. And I would tell you that I wouldn't feel bad about, you know, I just wouldn't feel bad about being who you are. And not to say that you feel bad, but, you know, everybody, they just have to take a chance, especially in art. In life, who am I kidding? In life, you really have to take that chance. And that's really up to you. You didn't sit on the sidelines. You literally grabbed life by the, what is it, 2 ounce balls. And you rode it all the way. And you made it to here. You're able to talk about your life, who you are, who you were, and who you are, and have this amazing book that people can look at and read and feel like they know you. That's so cool and yet so foreign to me, because I mean, this is like your heart and soul, right?
Yeah, it is at this point. I mean, you're actually bringing up a subject that I think about a lot, and that is the question of how far do you go in trying to develop your artistic instincts before you give up if you don't achieve success? And I was married to a fine artist for 30 years, and she was unable to achieve her goals. And she just doubled down like a gambler and spent 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day, 14 hours a day painting, trying to get that painting that was going to sell for 10 or 20 grand. And that never happened. And I read about people like Henry Miller. Well, he sacrificed everything. He burned friends. He borrowed money. He never paid back. He totally screwed his wife and daughter. But he became great. And he produced great literature that has brought an incredible amount of enjoyment to people all over the world. So you can say, okay, you know, we can forgive him for being an asshole because of what he has provided. But on the other hand, if you spend a lot of time, and particularly if you become an asshole in the pursuit of your art and you fail, that doesn't look very good.
I know. It's either you're a successful asshole or you're a failed asshole. You never, I don't think, you know, it's just the way it is. I think there's, you know, just like we do another podcast and we were talking to a psychologist and, you know, obviously as creators, there's these voices in your head that just you know, your creative voice is like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then your other creative voice is like, this is not anything. It's the negative and the positive. And I know by talking to everybody and even in my creative life, and I don't know how you feel about this, both you, Eric and Tom, but you have to, if you want to, I think, succeed, you have to fight those negative thoughts. When they come up, know that they exist, look yourself in the mirror and say, F you, we're gonna do this. We're getting this done. I'm writing this book. I'm shooting this movie. I'm fill in your blank. You just have to do it because everything, all these catchphrases that people, you know, it's like, and I know we're kind of getting in the weeds. Now we're talking about creative stuff, right? But,
right.
But it's like, just do it and have no fear. You can't have fear. If you want to go in to any kind of business for yourself, you have to have no fear. You can't fear failure. You can look failure in the face and go, I'm doing this whether you like it or not. But you have to wake up every day knowing that beyond where you are at this very moment, that the better is out there. It's like a little bird. They always fly. They have to look for food. They have to. And that's what I think creative people are. Wow. You know, when before we started rolling, I said, you know, the interview wants to go where it wants to go, right?
Right.
And this is part of it.
Well, there's a film that deals with the subject of artistic endeavor that I loved. It didn't get the interest that I thought it served. Maybe you've seen it. It's called Frank.
Frank. No.
Yeah, that was really good. I loved it.
Frank.
I've watched it about five times, and I even showed it to my mom when she was 100, and she burst out laughing. Wow.
Really?
Yeah,
it's really good.
Yeah, Frank, I gotta watch that. I gotta see it. What inspires you, Tom?
To write?
Yeah.
Well, just the experience I had inspires me, but a lot of books I have read really inspire me. When I decided I wanted to write, I just got a hold of every first person, true autobiographical type memoir that I could get my hands on, anything from Kit Carson's autobiography to Lauren Bacall's memoir, and a lot of other stuff. And they really inspired me. And I'd love to throw out some names. I guess at the top of the list, I would put Knut Hamsun. He's a Norwegian writer. He's the only writer I know of where I have enjoyed every single thing he's ever written. And he's written about 7 novels.
Wow.
And I liked Ferdinand Céline's Voyage au bout de la nuit, Voyage to the End of the Night, something like that in English. The big one, On the Road. I've read On the Road probably 20 times. To me, it's
one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's a poem. I mean, I just read it over and over again, and I get something different out of it every time I read it. And then more recently, I really love Mary Carr's The Liars Club. And I feel I really learned how to write, how to create similes as a result of reading her book.
Wow.
And then Jeanette Walls, The Glass Castle. That was a true account, and it was written in a very straightforward style, but with a lot of wry humor. And that was it was kind of the voice that I was, always wanting to write in. And so reading her book helped me a lot. And I've left out a
Well,
bunch of great writers, but that's a good list for starters.
that's
And then, oh,
amazing.
I've got to remember, I've got to mention You Can't Win by Jack Black. It's a fascinating book. I discovered it way back in the early 70s. No one seemed to know about it. So I had this bookstore hunting for copies, and they'd find copies hardbound, which I would pick up for $5. And I gave most of them away to friends, but I still have a couple. All of a sudden, it became a cult book, and the price of these old hardbound copies zoomed up to $200. Yeah. And it became so well known that it was actually reprinted. I think out of Berkeley, Black Lizard Books, wherever that is. Yeah, did a reprint of it. But it was a fascinating book. It was a book about a guy, kind of a loner type guy, who burglarized homes, mainly in the Bay Area, during the late 1800s and the early 1900s. And he has a really good writing style for an uneducated guy. It's kind of amazing that he was able to produce this book. But it's a great read. You can't win.
You can't win.
Wow.
Okay. All right.
And then
Man.
Junkie, I got to mention William Burroughs. So, yeah, I thought Junkie was hilarious. Yeah.
Tom, I've thoroughly enjoyed like having you on the show and talking about your book.
It was an absolute blast.
It's funny that I think a good conversation about great entertainment kind of takes your mind off of things.
Sure.
And this is absolutely one of those interviews that I haven't thought about anything else that I have to do today.
Well, it's been exciting for me to be on the show. I love
Thank
talking
you
about this
so
stuff.
much for that.
I tell you, I don't know if you have any book signings coming up and if you're on social media, but if you have anything coming up, please let us know
Yeah,
and we'll
totally.
put the word out for you.
Great, I appreciate that. I'm just starting and I know nothing about this publicity business, so I don't have much else. You're the first interview, by the way.
What?
Yeah.
Oh,
Well,
awesome.
I think I did a couple written interviews where I answered
Oh,
questions in writing.
right.
But yeah, this is the first podcast
Oh,
interview. Yeah.
whoa.
Okay.
Wow, we were your first podcast?
Oh, yeah. First and
Wow.
only at this point. Yeah.
Wow.
There'll
Well,
be
so
many
what?
more to come,
Oh,
my friend. Many more.
I tell you. Okay, so what was it like being on our show? Maybe do
Oh,
I want to
fantastic.
know?
I loved it. I loved
Oh,
it.
okay, good.
Awesome. And
Thank you.
when I said it's a pleasure to talk about this stuff, part of the reason for that is that for 3 or 4 decades, I just kept this stuff so under wraps, you wouldn't believe it. My own children did not have an inkling of this past of mine until I told them when they were in their early 20s. No idea.
Okay,
So,
wait.
holy
Okay, wait. The
cow.
second half of the show comes up right now. What was that like? Were
I
they
just put
okay?
it out of my mind, except when I was writing, when I would write it up. But I immersed myself in medicine and in my family, and so that's what I thought about. I
Were they surprised?
They were shocked.
Were they
Oh yeah,
in a good
I
way
could
or kind of
imagine. Good way.
okay, good,
Yeah,
good.
well, what my older son said, I was Han Solo.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Wow. You didn't even tell your
I told my
kids.
wife.
Oh, you did.
Okay.
Now,
But
did
pretty
you
much
tell
no
her
one else.
right when you met her, you told her your past, or when you started a relationship? Did she know when you started the relationship? Or did you tell
Remember,
her?
I think I waited a while before
Did
telling
you?
her. But Her response was kind of disappointing.
Oh, really?
She consistently said, "Well, I wish you had stayed in longer. We'd have more money."
Is that in the
Well,
book?
I
No,
think
that's
with
not in
that,
the book.
I think that Bump Bump was the best way to end the show. Tom, thank you so much for coming on. Links to where you can purchase the book will be in the bio if you're listening to us over on Anchor. And when the show goes up, we will definitely tag everything we can to help get the word out for the book. Again, Tom, thank you so much for coming on. And like we say each and every week, folks, remember, be excellent to each other.